This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
I shed a tear a little bit, but life goes on. It always does, it always will, and people will adapt. And the next program will come along, and it'll be better than the last program.
The final space shuttle mission launched from Cape Canaveral last week, leaving thousands of NASA employees and others whose lives were affected by the space program wondering what the future holds for them. Hello, and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Stuart Tiffin in Bonn, Germany, with what's new in the world of European science and technology news. Also coming up, the world's first quick response, or QR code-imprinted coin, has been minted in the Netherlands, and our Cynthia Taylor talks to the designer of the cutting-edge currency.
The idea is not to make a gadget. I wanted to represent the past and the present.
Plus, we'll be sitting down with an expert on the chemistry of the cosmos and hearing about new developments in the UK in nuclear fission, so stick around. The Fukushima disaster in Japan has prompted countries around the world to question their reliance on nuclear power. Germany is abandoning it altogether. But what if you could build a nuclear reactor which could not suffer a meltdown, using fuel which produced far less radioactive waste and which, to top it all, was 100 times more efficient than uranium? Well, in England, they're trying to do just that. Lars Bavanger reports from Daresbury near Liverpool.
Okay, so if you take key one.
Okay, the keys are the thing that ensures the accelerator can't be switched on while you're inside.
Susan Smith is the director at the Accelerator Science and Technology Centre at Daresbury. She's taking me to see EMMA, a particle accelerator which could help transform the way we produce nuclear power. It's got renewed attention here in the UK in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. Security's high here because accelerators themselves produce small amounts of radioactivity when they run.
So I give you that key and you maintain it in your person all the time. So it's your surety that no matter what happens and who comes out, you're safe within that accelerator.
Good to know. Particle accelerators have been around for nearly 80 years, but most have been big and expensive. EMMA would probably fit in your living room, a prototype of a new generation of smaller, cheaper accelerators, which means they could be more easily used for practical purposes like producing nuclear energy. Accelerators are also known as atom smashers. They can accelerate particles to smash into atoms and split them.
What would happen, they wondered, if they fired a neutron at a uranium nucleus? Why not try? So they tried. And the result? Nuclear fission.
In the 1950s, civilian nuclear power was still new, but it's made pretty much the same way today. Here's how it works. The core, or nucleus, of a uranium atom is split by firing a neutron particle at it. This releases nuclear energy in the form of intense heat. Uranium is a great nuclear fuel because it's fissile, which means its nucleus spontaneously shoots off neutrons, which smash into more uranium atoms, which shoot off more neutrons, and that's called a nuclear chain reaction.
The atomic age was born. Thorium is the other possible source of nuclear power. You can either do it using uranium plutonium, or you can do it using thorium.
Roger Barlow is a professor of particle physics and one of the main people behind the development of EMMA, the particle accelerator. He believes machines like EMMA will soon help produce nuclear power safer and cheaper using the element thorium rather than uranium. Thorium is plentiful across the world and potentially more efficient than uranium in energy production.
Thorium itself is not fission. If you just put together a lump of thorium, nothing will happen. But it can absorb a neutron and become uranium-233, which is fissionable.
That's where the accelerator comes in, isn't it? That you need
Yes.
big enough speed for it to have an effect.
You need big enough energy. You need big enough energy to make a fair number of neutrons to get the whole nuclear reaction going and keep it going.
So an accelerator like EMMA fires particles at the thorium core. The thorium atoms degenerate into uranium-233, which is different to the very rare naturally occurring uranium-235. But you have to keep bombarding the thorium with particles to keep the chain reaction going. And that's another great advantage, says Roger Barlow.
It cannot go critical. You can't have a Chernobyl-type incident. If you switch off the accelerator, then you switch off the chain reaction.
Roger Barlow and his colleagues at the Accelerator Science and Technology Centre believe thorium-based nuclear energy production could be achieved in as little as 7 years from now. It would take a lot of money because you'd also need to convert existing nuclear power plants to run on thorium. Governments have invested billions of euro in uranium-based nuclear power, and some say for them to switch to thorium will take a very long time. Nils Berma is a nuclear physicist with the Norwegian environmental NGO Bellona. He thinks thorium-based nuclear power can work, but that both the technology and the political will to invest in it will take time to mature.
I don't think thorium will be a big source of energy production in the near future, that meaning before 2050, which is the goal for all the climate cuts that needs to be done. Before 2050, there will still be a lot of fossil fuel being used, and it's need to be developed CO2 capture and storage methods in order to reduce the CO2 emission from fossil fuel before 2050.
Thorium-based nuclear power production might be some way off, but Western countries like the UK might not be able to afford being complacent about it. China announced in January a research and development programme aimed at not only starting production of nuclear power using thorium, but to secure the intellectual property rights for the technology involved. Lars Bevanger, Deutsche Welle Radio, in Daresbury, England.
The introduction of smartphones have allowed QR codes to become a trend all over the world. You hold up your phone, you scan it, and you get some sort of a secret treat. You spot them everywhere, on your concert tickets, on booklets, even in the middle of the street. But now the Netherlands is taking QR codes into a completely different level. They've just produced the world's first QR code coin, but sales were limited. They stopped selling them on Monday the 11th. Cynthia Taylor reports.
Thousands of tourists cross the famous Amsterdam canals every day with their travel books or tour guides. For those who are more technology savvy, they can check the several QR codes spread across town and find out more about that spot, from the history of a specific building to the canal's cruises schedules. The QR code has become a powerful tool in the marketing sector, and now it could be about to revolutionize mints across the world. In June, the Dutch Royal Mint released the world's first coin with a QR code on it. It's a limited edition to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Dutch Mint's building.
The idea is not to make a gadget. I wanted to represent the past and the present.
This is the man behind the idea, Spanish engraver Juanjo Sanchez.
I thought in an artistic way more, because I like the pattern, because I like the connection with the internet. But now we have the feedback, now we have the reply from the customers and internet, and it's a very good reaction.
Sanchez intended to use the QR codes as an educational tool. When you scan it with your mobile phone, you get more information on the history of the Dutch Mint and the building's architecture. But his artistic view ended up taking the digital and technological world by storm. If you type the words QR code coin on Google, you'll get over 5 million hits, all of this in just 1 month. And ideas keep on coming on new possible applications.
Some people say in the United States they can use it. It was quite funny because in the United States the coins is written the nominal, but it's not written the number. So for foreigners, sometimes it's difficult if you don't speak English to understand how much is the worth of the coin. So they say, why don't you put a QR code and we can see a five for 5 cents.
The QR code on the commemorative coin is in fact 100% engraved. There's no sticker or paint involved. And yet, you can clearly see the black and white contrast that QR codes use. In order to achieve that, the Mint had to adapt its technique. But the details behind this new methodology are kept secret.
But the trick is quite easy, because when you tilt a little bit the coin, At least if it's Polish, the background is completely black. So you have a big contrast. And even you don't need to tilt it. It works anyway with any kind of light and doesn't give any problem. Even the size is not a problem.
The coin has only been available on the Mint's online shop, and it costs up to 400 euros, so it will probably remain a niche product. But it may fail to grab the attention of the coin-collecting old guard, as coin shop owner Alan Kluk told me.
They're nice gadgets, but I'm an old-fashioned collector, so that doesn't mean a thing to me. I prefer the older coins, the real ones. This kind of coin doesn't get much value later.
The Royal Dutch Mint sold some 50,000 coins. It's a lower number for a commemorative coin, but that might have to do with the fact that it's been sold exclusively via the Mint itself. It was a conscious decision to make it more special and unique. Whether more similar coins will be produced, it's still unclear, although some clients have already showed interest in the idea. But the Mint warns that having QR codes in real money might not happen anytime soon. Cynthia Taylor, Deutsche Welle Radio, Utrecht.
DWWorld.de, Deutsche Welle's internet website. We bring you news and views from a European perspective. You'll find information about current affairs, business and economics, culture and lifestyle. You can even learn German with our online German courses. And, of course, we bring you the latest program details for DWTV and DW Radio. Deutsche Welle on the Internet at dwworld.de.
You're listening to Spectrum on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Stuart Tiffin. Remember, if you can't get to a radio when Spectrum comes on in your area, don't worry. You can listen anytime at dw-world.de/spectrum via streaming audio or as a podcast. Both are really easy and completely free to access. You can also follow SciTech updates and get a preview of what we're working on between shows on Twitter at dw_SciTech. Coming up, we'll sit down with a researcher at the Max Planck Institute and talk about the molecular makeup of a distant region of our galaxy. But first, here's Charlotte Chelsom-Pills with the news.
A new EU proposal seeks to gradually lower price caps on mobile phone and data roaming charges. By July 2014, mobile phone and data users travelling within the European Union could see their roaming charges capped at 24 cents per minute for outbound calls and 50 cents per megabyte transmitted, not including sales tax. The office of Neelie Kroes, European Vice President for the Digital Agenda, said that would be down from today's 35 cents per minute cap for outbound calls and a currently non-existent cap for data. Following a successful launch despite poor weather on Friday, July 8th, the Space Shuttle Atlantis docked with the International Space Station for one last hitch-up on Sunday on its final space voyage before the 30-year programme shuts down. When Atlantis returns to Earth, the United States will be without a government-run space program and no method of sending astronauts to space until private industry comes up with a new method, likely by 2015 at the earliest. The Russian Soyuz capsule will ferry astronauts to and from the ISS in the meantime. A former editor of the British tabloid News of the World was arrested over allegations of hacking into the voicemails of celebrities, the families of soldiers who died in combat, and a young woman who had been kidnapped and ultimately murdered. Andy Coulson, who had been editor at the News of the World from 2003 until 2007, had also served as Prime Minister David Cameron's communications director. The scandal caused Rupert Murdoch's News Corp media company to shut down the paper, which had the widest circulation in the UK at 2.9 million. 15 alleged members of the hacking collective Anonymous have been rounded up after 32 raids across Italy and Switzerland. The detainees, aged between 15 and 28, with five under 18, have been accused of performing denial-of-service attacks on Italian websites belonging to the government. In spite of the arrests, hacking under the Anonymous banner continues unabated. The so-called anti-security movement, promoted by the breakaway Anonymous faction Lulsec, has resulted in the compromise of numerous poorly secured web servers around the world. CERN, the physics lab based in France and Switzerland, has launched an open hardware license. The OHL will govern the use, copying, modification and distribution of hardware design documentation and the manufacture and distribution of products. The license came about thanks to electronic designers working in experimental physics laboratories who felt the need to enable knowledge exchange across a wide community and in line with the ideals of open science. The OHL is a share-alike license which grants users the freedom to study, modify, redistribute and manufacture design documentation, but requires that anyone who modifies or improves the design will have to share their work with the broader community. Researchers from Lancaster University in the UK have published a study showing that the massive bombing raids of World War II played a part in changing the weather. On the 11th of May 1944, almost 1,500 bombers took off from airfields in England and took to the skies over Europe. The contrails left behind by their aircraft blanketed the sky in cloud cover. The researchers compared historical data of the temperatures at locations not obscured by the artificial cloud cover with temperatures on the ground below the bombers and found that the contrails effectively blocked the heat from the sun by 0.8 degrees Celsius.
Charlotte Chelsom-Pills there with the news. Last week, an international group of scientists made up of representatives from the Max Planck Research Institute, the Swedish Onsala Observatory, and the European Space Observatory published findings in the Journal of Astronomy and Astrophysics, saying they'd discovered hydrogen peroxide in a distant part of our galaxy. The discovery was made using the APEX radio telescope, which is perched on top of a Chilean plateau at 5,100 meters, or nearly 17,000 feet. I sat down with Bérangère Paris at the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy in Bonn and discussed how hydrogen peroxide in space is important for you and me here on Earth.
So I am Bérangère Paris. I'm French and I've been working here at the Max Planck Institute for 6.5 years now. And I am studying star formation, so how stars like our sun are forming. And more particularly, I look at which chemistries are occurring in these environments. So we try to understand, for example, how some very important molecules on Earth are formed in these regions while the stars are forming.
What field does this fall under? Astrochemistry?
Yes, astrochemistry is actually a quite recent field of research. It's a booming field at the moment because we detect more and more new molecules thanks to the new technologies, the new telescopes, which are always more sensitive. And 50 years ago, the first molecules were detected in space, and since 50 years now, we have detected hundreds of molecules. And it's now the good time to try to understand the chemistry happening there, how they all form.
So what you were looking at APEX was Rho Ophiuchi?
Yes, it's a molecular cloud where star formation is taking place. So it's one of the regions the closest from us where we know that stars are forming. And the particular place where we found this molecule is a dense molecular cloud, so it's made of gas and dust. There is no star yet forming there, but it might be in a state where it will form stars. So it's a region very dense and very cold.
It's considered very cold at minus 250 Celsius.
Yes.
How is that colder than other parts of space?
Most of the interstellar medium is actually illuminated by UV from stars. So if you are close to a star, you will be always heated by this UV radiation. And here, these are the colder places because they are so dense that the UV radiation gets shielded, actually. So in the inside, it gets cold.
These cold conditions are important. Why?
Because they certainly determine the chemistry. We think that this molecule is formed on dust grains. So these molecular clouds are made of gas and dust particles. So these are small particles like the dust we know, which can be made of silicates or graphite or carbonates. And on the surface of these grains, the molecules from the gas can freeze out. So land on the grain where they can meet each other, and it can be a kind of catalyst for reactions. And for this to happen, you need also the temperature to be very low.
Now, how much hydrogen peroxide exists naturally in space, or where do you find it ordinarily?
Well, in space, except in Mars, where it was detected in 2004, it has never been seen anywhere. So up to now, I don't think so many searches had been done, but it was searched for in a couple of environments and not detected to a quite low level, actually, to a level of one molecule per 1 billion of hydrogen. This was the kind of upper limit where we didn't see the molecule, so it had to be less abundant than that. And here we found, for each 10 billion of hydrogen molecules, you have one molecule of peroxide, hydrogen peroxide. That's what we measured.
But you were confident that it would be there?
No, not when we started, no. But there was maybe some hints, actually, because this source was the only place where the molecular oxygen was detected, which is a related species in the chemistry. So the molecular oxygen history is kind of a long one because we have always thought there must be a lot of molecular oxygen in the universe, in the interstellar medium, because oxygen as an element is very abundant. But many searches had been done for molecular oxygen, and it was extremely difficult to detect. And finally, it was detected towards this same region in 2007 with the Odin telescope. So this had to be done by it's a satellite which observes outside of the atmosphere, because our atmosphere has so much molecular oxygen that you cannot see through it. So this row of Fucus is the only region where this oxygen had been observed. Molecular oxygen had been observed before our study. So it made it one of the best regions to try for this search.
Another areas of significance of your research is that hydrogen peroxide is considered related to the formation of H2O.
Yeah. Actually, we think that water forms on the grains with this process of having molecules of, either atoms of oxygen or molecules of dioxygen, so O2 or O3 ozone, going on the grains and reacting with H atoms coming on the grains. So it's an intermediate product of the formation of water, and we think it can really tell us a lot about how water forms.
With the APEX equipment, could you have seen that if it was there?
Well, H2O is also a molecule that you can hardly observe from the ground because of the atmosphere, which is very rich in water. So this is something that can be observed with satellites, and there is actually a satellite at the moment which can do that wonderfully, which is the Herschel telescope. And there is we have now a program to observe water in this same region using the Herschel telescope. So we are slowly gathering all the pieces of the puzzle, actually, to be able to relate the abundance of the hydrogen peroxide, the water, and to see if we understand it in the frame of our chemical models.
Finally today, we have a report from Christina Bergmann, who was in Cape Canaveral for the Shuttle Atlantis launch. She talked to several people who've worked for NASA over the 30-year shuttle program about what the future holds for them now the shuttle has launched for the final time. Holly Fox presents her report.
The Vehicle Assembly Building, or VAB as NASA employees call it, is one of the largest buildings in the world. It's got an area of more than 12,000 square meters, and it's 160 meters tall. The VAB is the place where the space shuttle was prepared for the flight to the International Space Station. The huge fuel tanks had to be mounted to the orbiter. More than 60 people work here, and 50-year-old Bobby Williams is one of them. He's been a foreman at NASA for 24 years.
I worked my way up to this position. I started out as a technician at the RPSF, which is a process rotation facility, working on the boosters. And then I moved into the ET world, where I was working on the external tank. And then this job opened up, and I applied for it and got it. So I've worked my way up the ladder. So no college.
For now, Williams still has a job, as do many of his colleagues, but that won't last for more than 2 years. When the space race was at its height, 10,000 Americans worked in some way as part of the space program, but that was long ago. Since 2009, employees have largely been let go or sent into retirement. By the end of August, half of the shuttle program's 5,000 employees will be cut. One of those transitioning is Jim Tully, the mayor of Titusville, a small town of 45,000 people near Cape Canaveral that's just across a small bay from the Kennedy Space Center. Before retiring in 2009, he was a software developer for United Space Alliance and spent more than 25 years in the aerospace industry.
I shed a tear a little bit, but life goes on. And it always does, it always will, and people will adapt. And the next program will come along, and it'll be better than the last program.
Mayor Tully is currently busy working on beautifying his city. NASA may have built the new bridge across the bay to its facility and gussied up Main Street, but his optimism cannot hide the fact that many Titusville homes are empty and dilapidated, and that on a Friday night, not much is happening on Main Street. Tully, though, says that even in the absence of the shuttle, the American space program will power forward.
The commercial launches will actually be more frequent, I'm sure of this, than NASA launches because, and that's not to say they won't be safe, they'll be safe, but the commercial people will figure out how to do it faster, better, and cheaper. They just will because it's the nature of commercial enterprise. If you look back to where aviation was in the 1920s, when the government started flying mail routes, and there were probably people who said, well, aviation is inherently unsafe and only the government can do it safely. Well, that turned out to be wrong. The commercial people got involved, and they knew from the very beginning they had to make aviation safe or people wouldn't ride on their airplanes.
In the more immediate term, though, there's another job that's keeping a lot of people busy. Stephanie Stilson was the head of production of the Space Shuttle Discovery. In the last 11 flights of the space shuttle, she was responsible for preparing the space shuttle for launch. But now that Discovery has been decommissioned, it sits in a hangar with its nose cargo door open. Stilson is getting it ready for its final journey to the Smithsonian Museum outside of the American capital, Washington, D.C.
We need to take those hazards away so that when Discovery, for instance, is sitting in the Smithsonian, individuals can walk around it with no fear. So we have hypergols that have to come off, cryogenics, freon, ammonia, hydrazine, hydraulics. So we're going through basically a deservicing of the vehicle.
That will take 9 more months. Next April, Discovery will be transported on the back of a Boeing 747 to Washington. So what does Stilson need to do to prepare for this final mission?
So I've kind of maybe put my head in the sand a little bit about it really being the end. I'm just kind of pressing forward with the work that we have. Fortunately, I'll get to do that same type of activity with Atlantis and Endeavour after their final flights. So right now, I think where the emotional part will come in for me will be once we take Discovery to the Smithsonian and it's time for me to walk away and not get to work with Discovery on a daily basis and the team that does that. Now, of course, we'll have Endeavour and Atlantis to go process, so we'll be jumping right into the mix when we get back. But that point will be a little bit sad for me. I think that'll be a realization that my time with Discovery is really coming to an end, and now I'm going to have to rely on someone else to be responsible for taking care of Discovery, and so that'll be a hard task for me.
Holly Fox, Deutsche Welle Radio.
That's all for this week on Spectrum. Remember, you can always find us between shows at dw-world.de/science and on Twitter at dw_SciTech. And you can send us story tips, questions, comments, praise, or dissent via email to feedback.english@dw-world.de. Also, please be sure to put Spectrum in the subject line. If you like, you can also send us a postcard or a letter to Deutsche Welle, Spectrum, English Service, 53110 Bonn, Germany. No matter how you contact us, don't forget to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. From Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn, Germany, I'm Stuart Tiffin, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the programme. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.